Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Bernie Marino is looking out for himself, not us.
Marino is totally out of touch, and his company has a history of discriminating against its own workers. Marino has even faced multiple lawsuits for racial discrimination.
One black man sued for being told, "You black men out there tried to hide your criminal records," and being passed over for less qualified white applicants. Moreno has shown his colors. If he's elected senator, he's liable to rubber stamp Trump's radical Project 2025 agenda 100% and turn back the clock for Ohio. From taking away our overtime pay to gutting our public schools and rolling back our civil rights, we can't let Moreno take us backwards. We can count on Sherrod Brown to continue doing what's right to protect Ohio's workers and families. Register to vote by October 7th at OhioVoterGuide.org and re-elect Sherrod Brown.
Paid for by Ask New People, AskNewPeople.org, which is responsible for the content of this ad. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Ringside Chaos, the professional wrestling discussion segment of the Bear of Texas podcast and Paint Dream Pipe Bomb Productions. Ladies and gentlemen, you all know who I am, but let's welcome back Brooklyn's finest, Mark freaking Braverman. And today we are going back in time because we are going to talk about the Great American Bash from 1989. As always, this show is dedicated to the memory of Mark's younger brother, Jeffrey Braverman, but today, the anniversary of 9/11.
A tragedy.
Also to pay some respects to all the innocent lives that were lost that tragic day.
Unfortunately, I was supposed to be in Manhattan that day, as a matter of fact. I was supposed to be the front. I had a job interview that day not too far from the Trade Towers, and I was supposed to be the friend who worked in the towers. Unfortunately for all of us, 9/11 happened, and sadly enough, he didn't make it out of the building. I miss him. I miss him very much.
I remember.
Thank you. I remember that day so vividly. It was an absolute nightmare. Alex, I think you're too young. You were probably too young to remember that day at all, but I remember every detail of it.
Well, I was 8 years old. It was another day at school, being bullied by kids, being verbally and emotionally abused by teachers, and of course other school staff. It was just another day at work, but I had no idea why. Everybody, all of a sudden, the teachers, everybody was in a panic mode. They called everybody had to go home early, although a lot of them could not because the parents were at work. Mm. I had no idea what the heck was going on because, as you said, I was too young to understand. And then eventually I knew what happened. And, of course, obviously, if you know me and my history and everything, you know that, unfortunately, it did not go too well for me. But
well, it didn't go well for any of us.
Years it's been, if my math is correct.
Yes, I was already in my 20s when it happened. And I was actually shaving to go to the job interview that I had. And my uncle, who was living with at the time, knocked on the door and told me I better get out of here. And I said, "But Jared, I'm shaving." He goes, "No, get the hell out of here right now." So I walked out half shaven. This side was shaven, this side was not. So that shaving cream on my face. And when I saw what happened, I just dropped the razors and just lost my mind. And I just started to, I'm not ashamed to say that I started to cry my eyes out. And I was panicking because I live here. And when you live here, not to say that it wasn't tragic, but when you live in New York, we never thought anything like this would ever happen to us. And to watch those towers fall was just the worst day ever. So to all the victims that we lost in 9/11, to the NYPD, the FDNY, EMS, and all the first responders that we lost, we thank you so much for the ultimate sacrifice. We love you. We miss you. And we will never, ever forget you. And that's a promise.
Amen. Again, this episode, as we discuss the 1989 Great American Bash on the 23-year anniversary of 9/11. As always, like I said, this show is always dedicated to the memory of your younger brother, Jeff. But also today, we dedicate it to all the innocent lives that were lost. Just such a tragic.
It really was. And
It really was.
Before anybody asked me how, if anybody really wants to know how it was, you can always contact me on Facebook, and I'll give you a little, I don't want to talk about all the details on this show, but if you really want to know what New York was like, you can always contact me on Facebook, and I'll let you guys, I'll give you my insight on it. But any old dumb comments will be deleted, of course.
Yeah,
it's not the time for that right now.
It's not the time, and come on, it's bad enough that this country already suffers through divided hate because you just simply cannot have your own opinion. Mm. But again, we're not going to get into that because Mark and I make a perfect example of that, because politically we disagree. But you know what? Mark and I say, screw politics. Let's bond over our love for professional wrestling, and this is what we do. And me watching the 1989 Great American Bash,
amazing show,
was actually suggested by Mark, although Mark actually told me to watch I think it was Starrcade, correct?
It was Starrcade night.
Which is in the plans. I also want to watch Halloween Havoc, so apparently we might go on a little 1989 rant, but I'm telling you, the 1989 Great American Bash was just, it was fantastic. I mean, that right there, ladies and gentlemen, that's wrestling.
It was 1989 was an amazing year for WCW. WCW was not cartoonish like the WWF back in the day. You were not going to find guys walking around in police uniforms or walking around with the snake, or you know, walking around dressed like a rooster. You weren't going to find that in WCW. What you were going to find was action-packed wrestling. And the fact that WCW here in the North was very, very hard to find. Unless you had closed-circuit cable back then, there really was no cable in 89. Cable was a baby at that time. So it was really hard to find WCW at the time. But if you're able to find it and you loved it, it was such an amazing product at the time. And because there was no Eric Bischoff, there was none of the quirky nonsense that we had when he was in charge. So 89 was just an amazing year for WCW. It really was.
And this was actually this was not the first Great American Bash overall. This was the first Great American Bash that was produced by WCW under the banner of the National Wrestling Alliance.
Yes.
Before that, it was basically produced by Jim Crockett Promotions under the NWA banner. So Jim Crockett Promotions had become World Championship Wrestling. And if I'm correct, this took place when Ted Turner acquired the company. Now, this was actually the fifth Great American Bash.
And
this
took place
July of 89 in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes, it did. And this actually is one of my favorite ones. This is one of my more favorite of the Great American Bash that we've had throughout the years. So, Alex, let's get right to it. This is going to be a whole lot of fun.
It is. And, you know, one thing to point out at first, if all these wrestling fans, you all remember the main event, but what's interesting is that Ric Flair, arguably the greatest heel villain in professional wrestling, was not heel in this show.
Nope.
But we'll get to that. But, you know, as I look at the wrestling card, all these tremendous names in these matches and just how, you know, of course, the War Games, we see NXT War Games and Survivor Series. I mean, all that came from this. I mean, we're going to talk about the name, the Great American Bash. That is creative and that's unique and that's great to call a pay-per-view. And we all know who came up with that name, don't we, Mark?
The legendary American Gym himself, Dusty Rhodes, who did name this pay-per-view. He also invented the War Games, as a matter of fact. So even though he's been gone several years, and of course we do miss the legend, his legacy in wrestling lives on. It lives on through War Games, lives on through the Great American Bashes, it lives on through, if you watch, to go back and watch the Clash of the Champions, which is also his idea. A lot of things in wrestling came out of the amazing mind of Dusty Rhodes. So his legacy still lives on, as is many other wrestlers' legacies still, who we've lost over the years. And their legacy will always live on, as long as people continue to watch professional wrestling.
Absolutely. Okay, Mark. Match number one. A King of the Hill double ring battle royal.
It's called the Triple Crown Battle Royal, as a matter of fact. And the rules in this one were a little bit interesting because you had the double ring set up for the War Games. They took a little bit of advantage of this. And the Triple Crown Battle Royal worked like this. All 15 wrestlers started off in ring number one. As they got thrown on the top rope and eliminated, they had to start fighting in ring number two. The sole survivor, which is very funny, the sole winner of Battle Royal ring number one did not have to get into ring number two, because ring number two, all the guys got thrown on the top rope. How this worked was the guy who won ring number two was going to go against the guy who won ring number one, and then they were going to have it out. But that did not happen.
Yeah, I was having a hard time understanding how this match works, but what got my attention is the competitors, you know, the Skyscrapers, you know, of course, not long ago, Psycho Sid, may he rest in peace, you know, with Dan Spivey. I mean, they're the ones who actually won this match. We look at the competitors as well. Brian Pillman, rest in peace. This is way before he was the Loose Cannon. And I mean, at that time, he was, you know, young, in his mid-20s. Kevin Sullivan, Mike Rotunda. This is before Mike Rotunda was IRS. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, the Steiner brothers, Ron Simmons, Terry Gordy. Scott Hall was in this match too.
Yes, he was. And you will not recognize, if you watch this match, you're not going to recognize Scott Hall. I promise that.
No.
Because he wasn't tan yet. He was tall. And he had that cheesy mustache, and he looked a whole lot different than what we're used to. And he had short hair, so he was not the Razor Ramon character years later on. Mm. He was just Scott Hall, the wrestler.
No, so he was not Razor Ramon.
No, this was his first run in WCW.
Yeah.
So most people don't
know.
Exactly.
His first run, yes.
Right. He had two runs in WCW, both successful, by the way. But absolutely. In this one, he had the mustache. He wasn't tan yet. He had chest hair. He was really strong and tall. Good strapping looking guy. But he didn't win the match.
No. The skyscrapers did. And they won by last eliminating Dr. Death Steve Williams.
Yep, who also came. And a lot of them wrestled twice on this show, which is even more interesting. But
yeah, that's just how it was back then. You more often than not, you would wrestle more than one match. You know, I think way back then in the day, Ric Flair, he always wrestled at least an hour.
He would wrestle an hour one night, then go another scene and wrestle an hour the next night. But
that's
the thing
was
is,
back then, especially in the National Wrestling Alliance, that's usually how it goes when you're on top, when you're the champion, when you're the top draw.
Yep. And here's the thing. It was supposed to be the winner gets $50,000. Because the Skyscrapers are a tag team, here comes their manager, who most people don't realize was actually Teddy Long, back then known as Theodore Long. He actually picked up the microphone and said, this is not going to have, my boys are not going to wrestle each other. We're just going to split the 50 grand. Each man will get 25 grand, and they walked right out of the ring. So it was an interesting battle royal to see all these guys tossing and turning and throwing each other over the top rope. The concept was very interesting. I just loved it. I mean, I loved it from top to bottom. I really did. I'm not really big on battle royals, but all the action in there, throwing people over, that some of the dives that these guys took, diving from one ring to another, it was absolutely brilliant. It was such a fun card. It really was.
It was. I mean, this whole show basically showed us the wrestling brawling type from way back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't see this anymore. This is the old school style, which is so unique.
It is.
This is before you had hard, you know, the hardcore ECW stuff and then the comedy wrestling and all that. I mean, comedy wrestling, I appreciate it. I mean, I get it because wrestling's changed, but this is way back then. Comedy wrestling back then would have been an absolute insult to the business. Now, of course, Jim Cornette still says that it is, but I do not want to get too deep into that guy because I can't stand that guy, even though we're going to have to talk about him in this one. But
well, we're going to talk about him, but...
And I mentioned, because the second match, if we're ready to move on, was Brian Pillman versus Bill Irwin.
What a match this was.
It was. I mean, seeing Brian Pillman, you know, at the time, again, he was in his, I would say, mid to late 20s. Really, you know, had you know, the Hollywood star looks. I mean, he was a baby face. I mean, this is way before he was the loose cannon.
It's also before he joined up with Stone, with Steve Austin to join the Hollywood Blondes.
And of course, back then, Stone Cold was stunning Steve Austin.
Well, he wasn't in the company yet in 89. He didn't come in for another year. But at the time, this match, you had a lot of things going on here. This was speed versus power. You had a lot of wrestling going on here. You had him throwing, you had Flying Brian going off the ropes, drop kicking, flying all over the place. Aerial moves, and then when he got caught, it became power moves. They both wrestled very, very well in this match. And how Flying O'Brien won it was incredible, because you hear Jim Ross go, "Oh, there's no way he's gonna be able to do that." They use both rings in this match, and I love that the referee just went, "Okay, go ahead, use both. I don't care as long as you hit the floor." It really was a lot of fun. It was an interesting match to see, and how Flying O'Brien won it though. What a move for him. What a move. And I think of Billy Irvin was halfway in the middle of ring number one.
Oh yeah, I know.
It was incredible how he won this match.
Again, the wrestling we saw, but I can't even say we, because this is before I was born. The wrestling that it was back then.
This was what you had a lot of times. You had power versus speed, and traditionally, power usually wins. But it was Flying Brian who surprised everybody by jumping from one of the turnbuckles in ring one that was close to ring two and on the other side. He jumped from one turnbuckle over another turnbuckle in the air, does a dive, and just pins the guy. It was incredible. It was an incredible suicide dive, whatever. I think it was called a high cross body back then. He does a high cross body, Irwin catches him, they fall down, 1, 2, 3, and Flying Brian runs out of the ring. And by the way, he wrestled the match before this, so he wrestled two matches in a row, and that's not easy.
No.
Give credit to me, and he was in that triple battle royal for a while, the triple crown royal for a while. You got to give him credit for that, too. He came into this match tired, or he came into this match tired already, so.
I think Irwin was in the match, too.
I think he was, but Irwin went out a little bit quicker than Flying Brian did. Yeah. So to come back and wrestle two matches in a row, that's not easy.
No.
So this was it. We miss Flying Brian to this day. And I liked him better as Flying Brian than the Loose Cannon character. Because when he was Loose Cannon, they took some things away from him. But when he was Flying Brian, he was flying around that ring. Wow, this man could go. He really could.
I mean, with his Hollywood movie star looks, I mean, he was the action guy you would see in an 80s film. Fighting the bad guys, like, you know, like being like, you know, the police, you know, detective, all that, you know. Everybody knows about those action films from back then. And he was that part.
He
and
really
of course,
was.
You know, the lady, you know, he's like the hottest guy for the ladies. So he had it all. He had the charisma, the swagger, the talent. I mean, he had everything. He had it all.
He was, and you could tell that he trained in the hard dungeon by his technique and his perfection and how crisp he moved in the ring. He never hurt an opponent. He never injured an opponent. He always took care of his opponent. He always took care of the ring. He always took care of whoever he was working with. And everybody said they loved to work with him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So an amazing talent was this man. He really is. And we really do miss him. Excuse me. We really do miss him to this day.
Absolutely. Well, now we're in the third bout. Some tag team action, Mr. Braverman, sir. The Skyscrapers versus the Dynamic Dudes.
I felt bad for the Dynamic Dudes because they just got their butts handed to them in this match. I mean, They tried their hearts out. They really did. But when you're wrestling guys who are almost 7 feet tall, 300 pounds of, you know, pure power, you know what's going to happen to you. You know, and the Dynamic Dudes were kind of like the version of the Rockers. You know, the ladies all loved them. The kids wanted to be them, and they're throwing out frisbees, and they're high-fiving, and they're having a good time. But when Teddy Long, again, there goes that name again. When Teddy Long let the skyscrapers go, he let them go. And he really did. It was just, it was a beating. Let's be honest here.
And that's the Dynamic Dudes, Shane Douglas and Johnny Ace, who, of course, we know is John Laurinaitis.
That's right.
Hey, let's go on. No, John Laurinaitis back then, you know, a very, very good wrestler. I mean, had a well-decorated career in Japan. Yeah, the Dynamic Dudes was definitely, again, like, you know, a typical babyface team from the 80s, dudes from the beach, you know, like that.
They were like the Rock. They were the WCW's version of the Rockers.
Yeah, it's just, I think, a slightly different gimmick, because they were more like beach surfer dudes, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. The Dynamic Dudes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was still, though, this was just a beating. They ended it with the powerbomb, and I knew the second that they hit the powerbomb, it was over. But, again, the Dynamic Dudes, I gotta give them a little credit in this match. They made the skyscrapers hit each other, which was just classic 80s wrestling. They were flying all over the ring. They tried the high-flying stuff. They hit him with a couple of drop kicks. And then the skyscrapers went, okay, we're going to stop you right now. And there came the double powerbomb, and the match was over.
The match went 9 minutes, so.
It wasn't like it was a beating, but it really was. It wasn't a squash, but it was about an 8.5-minute beating. Let's be honest here.
Well, I kind of say it for the Dynamic Dudes, it was a losing effort because they did fight. It was. Yeah, they did at one point. They did come close a couple of times to getting one. So, yeah, I would say losing effort. But, you know, again, you know, good guys versus the bad guys. The bad guys are the bigger ones, and then they win. You can tell the skyscrapers and the Dynamic Dudes, they were having fun. They were enjoying working with each other. They were in the ring doing what they love. And, of course, you know, Sid Vicious, Psycho Sid, rest in peace. And, of course, with, you know, his tag team partner, Dan Spivey. Man, great. Absolutely great.
You could tell that they wanted to be there.
Oh, yeah. And they were so happy.
They were having a good time with this match. They really were. I enjoyed this 9-minute match. I really did. I'm not calling it a classic, but I'll say this. I did enjoy the match.
Yeah.
And I'm honestly not a Shane Douglas fan by any means necessary. Never have been. But his first run in WCW was actually pretty fun to watch.
Yeah.
He really was.
And he was a young guy at the time, you know, in his mid-20s. And. Yeah, great tag team action. But it's just funny that we go from tag team action to a tuxedo match between two, not wrestlers, but two of the greatest managers of all time in a tuxedo match. Jim Cornette versus Paul E. Dangerously.
And if you watch this match, you're going to find something funny about Paul Heyman. He was a lot thinner. He had a full head of hair. He had what we called a mullet back then, short on top, long on the bottom, because I had one. That was the big style back in these. If you were a guy, you could pull it off. He was a lot thinner. He moved in the ring. He was still funny as hell, still had that booming voice that he has. And Jim Cornette was just a clown that Jim Cornette is.
And of course, Paulie had the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I think before the match, both guys delivered great promos backstage with, I think Gordon Solie was the backstage interviewer for this one. Jim Ross was the announcer. I forget the name of the other guy. But I remember Jim Ross, we're getting ahead of it, but that passion of the announcing was, it's incredible. But
well, I was going to mention this later, but the difference in the announcing, I'm glad you mentioned that, was there was no heel commentator in this one.
Yeah, I know, there wasn't.
Pulling it right down to me. It was like WWF at the time. They had Gorilla Monsoon battling Jesse Ventura, which was great for comedy. But again, WCW was not cartoonish and not comical wrestling. Exactly. This was more of, this is what the business should be.
Yeah.
So they had the commentators calling right down the middle, and Jim Cornette's commentating was unbelievable the whole night. He really did well.
Jim Ross, sorry. No, not corny. Not communist corny.
My apologies. I was thinking about Cornette at the time. I'm sorry. But he just called it like Jim Ross is, the passion that he has for the business. And he wasn't JR back then. They called him Jim Ross back then. So he didn't get the JR tag until they came to WWF. But This was so much fun to watch. Plus the commentators. And honestly, this was the comedy hour match. This
really was. You know what's interesting about this is that Jim Cornette was not heel. He was actually babyface in this one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
And Paulie, now, as far as I know, Paulie Dangerously, I don't think he was ever a babyface as a manager.
In ECW,
not WCW, at least.
WCW, no. ECW, yes. WWE, not really.
Yeah.
But in ECW, he was. But this was just comedy, just watching them rip each other's clothes off. And it was, this was not, so, I didn't really watch the match. I fast forwarded through this one, to be honest with you. So, this is all you.
I think the highlights is the promos that both guys delivered before the match, especially Jim Cornette's, especially because Jim Cornette mentions that Paulie knows about Jim's knee injury from like several years ago, and that, I forget what the name of the match was, but there was a spot where Jim Cornette fell and I think completely blew out his knee.
Yes.
Yeah, and of course, he still had the brace, and he still hadn't fully healed from it, so.
Yes.
But yeah, this match was the comedy, was certainly the comedy of the night. So, and I honestly believe Jim Cornette was, let's be honest, he was probably, I feel like he was miserable doing this particular match.
They were both miserable during this match. They did this for comic, like we said, in every pay-per-view, there's always one where you have to, go to the refrigerator, or if you're in the audience, you want to go to use the men's or the ladies' room where you want to try to get an autograph, or you want to try to buy merchandise. That was this match. Every pay-per-view has one or two of these, and this was this pay-per-view's, excuse me match. I'll put it to you that way. There's another term for it, but I don't want to be nasty. Yeah. So that's what this was.
Yeah, of course. So get rid of that. So we got through that one. Paulie versus Corny. Now we get to Texas Tornado action. The Steiner Brothers against the Varsity Club, Kevin Sullivan and Mike Rotunda.
Yes.
Now, remember, this is before the IRS character, because this is WCW, and Rotunda is basically, would wear an orange wrestling singlet, which symbolizes and reminds us of his time, because Rotunda was a decorated amateur wrestler who wrestled collegiately at Syracuse University.
Here in New York, yes, he did, and Syracuse is known for their wrestling, to have amazing wrestlers. Mike Rotunda was an excellent amateur wrestler, brought it to WCW, and if you don't know the difference between a tag team match and a Texas Tornado match, the difference is in a Texas Tornado match, there's no rules. You don't have to tag in and out. There's no count outs. We go to somebody gets pinned. That's the difference between a Texas Tornado match, which was named Alex after your home state, as a matter of fact.
Well, because, part of Texas is part of Tornado Alley, so I guess. I don't know.
Also, the person.
I mean, I don't know if the match itself, if the concept of this match was created in a promotion in Texas, if it was for WCCW or if it was, for the Funk promotion up in Amarillo, but.
I think it was, as a matter of fact. I'm not too positive on that.
But this match was quick, yeah. It was 4.5 minutes.
It was 4.5 minutes because of what happened later on in the show. But it was still, that was very hard hitting. They used chairs, they used the guardrails. As a matter of fact, Rick Steiner made one guy do the splits on the guardrail, which, believe me, you hurts. they went all over the place. It was a very fast, hardcore match. And back then,
representing Michigan. Because they both also wrestled collegiately at the University of Michigan. Scott actually was a 3-time Big Ten runner-up when he was at the University of Michigan.
Yes. So they had to be careful how far that they took these matches, these hardcore tag team matches. They didn't want to see anybody get really messed up. They were always quick. They were always fast back in the day. But it was a very interesting match. Also, the Steiners, for one of their first times, had a manager, and their manager was Missy Hyatt. So that was pretty fun to watch her come out, and she's a beautiful girl. So yeah. It was, for a 4-minute match, it was very interesting.
It certainly was, yeah. And the Steiner brothers, I mean, the fact of the matter is, people don't even know that's Scott Steiner, that's Big Papa Pump. That's before the short hair, the bleached hair, and
And the roids.
Okay. All right, Mark. All right. Take it easy, Mark.
No, he was on roids.
All right. Well.
But it was still, though, it was it's good to see the Steiner Bros in the ring anytime. Anytime we get to see Rick and Scott, it's a lot of fun.
And I think this was before their first run in the WWF.
Yes. Their first one came in 1993.
Yeah.
This was 4 years before.
But it's just amazing. People don't know that's Scott Steiner, but, you know.
And that's also
just
the big
that's just before. That's just before Big Papa Pump.
Yep.
Yeah, before yep. the holla, if you can hear me.
Oh, please.
Oh, those days. But yeah, the Steiner brothers were amazing. But now we get to the sixth match on the card, sir. And this is our first championship, a singles match for the NWA World Television Championship. The defending champion Sting fighting the great Muta, which ended in a double pin.
Well, kind of, sort of. I think Sting actually won. This was two of the greatest to ever wrestle in this company. Sting was the champion. The great Muta. This was actually his first championship match of many in WCW. And of course, Muta being the martial artist that he is. One had Gary Hart. That was the great Muta. The other had Eddie Gilbert, who didn't really. Eddie Gilbert, of course, wound up going to ECW for a while. They really did some phenomenal stuff in this match. Muta with his martial arts, Sting with his ability to wrestle anybody. This was a classic match. It really was. I enjoyed this match thoroughly. Anytime you put Sting in a ring, it's going to be fun. And the great Muta was just as incredible as he was.
He was. And speaking of the great Muta, I mean, the wrestling gear, the red martial arts pants that he was wearing, the face paint. You know, I didn't even know that Muta was a heel, actually.
Muta was heel, yeah, sure.
Was he heel for, like, most of his career? Was he just heel for that particular time?
He was heel. He was heel a lot, yes.
Yeah, because, now, keep in mind, back then, the NWA was still in a huge working relationship with New Japan. So Muta was not actually technically signed to the NWA and WCW. He was with New Japan, but, again, the partnership. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it reminds us just how great the working relationships are. I mean, you still see that today with AEW and New Japan and whatnot, so...
And Ring of Honor.
And Ring of Honor, of course. But yeah, it was awesome. And, you know, of course, I think in this match, Muta had never been pinned, had never lost a match in WCW.
Never lost.
So obviously, they decided, yeah, well, you know, because it's like that, he obviously can't win. At the same time, Sting is one of our top draws, arguably the top babyface. Flair was facing this in this show. But it was just amazing. Sting was my age. In this show, a little mm-hmm. younger than I am now, but around my age, and see that he just retired a few months ago.
Sting's career has been legendary. No matter,
this is not Crow Sting. This is the Surfer Sting. This is before the Crow Sting.
Mm-hmm.
I always say, while the Crow Sting is overwhelmingly more popular than the Surfer Sting, while I do in fact prefer the Crow Sting, I actually have a lot of respect and admiration for the Surfer Sting.
I actually the Surfer Sting better, to be honest with you. I thought it was more of a better character for him. I thought it was more of a looser character for him. But that's just me, because I've been watching Sting forever.
Yeah, so it makes sense. And you know, everybody knows I do have actually a Sting action figure, but it's an AEW one, and I want to see if I can find more action figures from back then. Like, I want the Crow Sting from WCW, then I want to find a action figure of the Surfer Sting, you know, just to add to the collection.
Check eBay.
Obviously. Because, speaking of a WCW action figure, I do have a Jericho one when he was Lionheart.
Nice.
So
this, to me, was just as classic as it gets. Pure wrestling, pure fun. They flew all over the ring. They used both rings. They went in and out of the ring. They suplexed each other. They came off the top rope. They did so much stuff. If you like classic wrestling matches, you're going to love this one. This was a fun, fantastic match. I was glued to my seat watching it. This was just a lot of fun. It really was.
It was. Now, I will say, even though it ended up in a double pin, I think it probably would have made more sense if it ended like, if Muta had been disqualified, I don't know. I would have said, you know what, since they both had managers, both managers get in the ring, and then there's a huge brawl, I would just say ended in a no contest. I probably would have preferred a no contest finish than a double pin. That's probably just me, though. That's probably just me.
You're thinking of today's wrestling, not back then.
Well, see, there you go. There you go. It's because, you see, for me to watch these shows from back then, it's to further educate myself on how it was back then. Now, Mark, you've told me many times that I'm already educated well in the wrestling from back then, but I always say there's always more to learn.
You have to remember, this was not the late 1990s, early 2000s, where managers can jump in the ring like that. That was a no-no. And the reason why they had such a weird finish was because they really didn't know what to do. So you had Sting go for the over-the-shoulder suplex. Sting's arm was up. Moody's arm looked like it was down. Very controversial finish. And they said at the end of the show they were going to settle it on Saturday night's main event, which they actually did. The belt wound up going to Sting, if I remember correctly, but I could be wrong. You could have had the TV time limit, but back then TV title matches did have a 15-minute time limit, but with Sting and Muda, it wouldn't have worked because the crowd just would have screamed out for 5 more minutes. So it's kind of hard to decide who was going to do what in this situation, but honestly, I would have preferred a clean finish. But I was very happy with the match either way.
Sting was still technically the champion because I looked at the belt thing. Yeah, so I guess he was never, the title reign didn't really end, but still, they settled it like that, so. Sting just, you know, I mean, this was like, he was like 3 years into his career, but he was just completely, you can't say he was green. Okay, oh no.
No, he was not green.
Far too a master in his craft to be considered green. No, Sting was beyond a student at that point. Sting, you know, again, you know, man.
He already beat Flair, so I mean, you know.
Yeah, he already had that huge feud with the Four Horsemen.
Sure, so. And he was a horseman, so there you go.
Yeah, he was a horseman because, it's just, you know, for me, in my case, the fact that Sting was around my age during that time, and saying that, again, a few months ago, he officially retired at the age of, in his mid-60s, a career that went from, what was it, 85? Man.
A phenomenal career.
Man, unbelievable. Like 40 career. Years. 40 years.
Amazing career.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Right. That's why his fan base is as big as it is. Absolutely. And the funny thing was, everybody said that Sting is the WWF's Ultimate Warrior. Sting came first. Mm-hmm. Warrior was actually tag team partners with Sting in WCW for a while, and then Warrior took off. Sting got his character first. Warrior was a completely different monster than Sting. And again, if WCW had the TV popularity of WWF, the war would have been a lot better back then, and WCW might have actually taken over. But because Vince had more money and had more contracts in the North and had more contracts in the Midwest and in the Far West, that's why WWE had more of a fan base. But if you cross the Mason-Dixon line where you live, if you went down there and said, I'm a WWF fan, you got smacked in the mouth. Because in Texas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, all the great states we have in the South, they were all WCW fans. Even wrestling. Baltimore, Maryland. Right.
Yeah, we wrestle, son. We wrestle, right. Boy.
You were wrestling fans.
You know, and you mentioned Ultimate Warrior and Sting. I mean, everybody knows like which wrestler out of the two established the more positive legacy, but I don't want to take anything away from the Warrior, but his in-ring ability is often highly criticized, as well as the ability to cut promos.
It wasn't only his promos, his wrestling ability was limited. Sting could wrestle anybody. Sting could wrestle a paintbrush and make it look good. Warrior didn't have that ability. So there's a difference. I discovered WCW by accident because when I was a kid, I was a big WWF fan. I loved it. Oh, WWF's the greatest company in the world. Well, a friend of mine somehow had Short Circuit TV one day and invited me over on a Saturday. Back then you had WWF Saturday morning and then you had WCW Saturday night. So my friend showed me WCW. And I went, wait a minute, this is better. I like this better.
Yeah.
So that's how I discovered WCW, and I was a fan as long as the company, until the company had what they had at the end of their career. But that's why I discovered WCW.
Despite the issues and everything, look, Warrior made amends with everybody before his tragic demise. That's the most important thing out of everybody. While things may have gone bad with the whole thing with Vince and the working relationship with other wrestlers, he made amends, and that's what I focus on. So, yeah. But
yes, he does.
But as far as Sting goes, man, I love the guy. Love him. But now we got to go to the next championship match for the NWA United States Heavyweight Championship. The total package, Lex Luger versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Before we talk about this match, I'm going to say this very, very clearly. I have lost all respect for Lex Luger, and I call him Lex Luger because of what he did to Elizabeth. I have lost all respect for that man. I will talk about this match cleanly and fairly because that's what the fans of the show and wrestling fans demand of us, but I have lost all respect for Lex Luger. I always have, and I always will. I respect the man.
Well, you mentioned that. I mean, how many times have I called Jim Cornette a communist?
Yes. But the difference is between is that Jim Cornette didn't kill anybody.
Well, he threatened to.
Threatening is one thing, doing is another.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, but...
And Jim Cornette never went to jail.
Well, back then, because remember how wrestling was back then, but...
There's fake and then there's real.
We don't use the word fake here, Mark.
I apologize. There's storyline and then there's real.
Yeah, kayfabe.
But we will discuss this match because I'm professional. This match was supposed to be no disqualification rules, but Lex still picked up the microphone and said, and pitched a bitch and said, this will not be no DQ rules. It's my way or the highway.
Typical heel stuff.
Yes, yes.
And for Ricky Steamboat, I think in the previous pay-per-view, he lost his title to Ric Flair, which again, we'll be getting to.
Yes, he did.
Ricky Steamboat.
Amazing talent.
Was he ever a heel, just out of curiosity?
To my knowledge, no, but I could be wrong.
Because let's be honest, his character as a heel maybe would have worked, maybe not, but some would say from back then, no, because just the way he was, it was always like that. A heel turn for him just wouldn't have materialized because it was never probably thought of. It would not have worked. It would have been bad. But
it would have been terrible.
It's just interesting how the match ended. You know, him being the babyface, losing his mind and all like that. I mean, even babyfaces can be pushed to their limits.
Well,
and Ricky Steamboat was.
Lex introduced the chair, but Steamboat got caught. That's the difference. The heel brought in the chair, but the face got caught. That's how it ended. But before it ended, it was actually a very good wrestling match. It really was.
It certainly was. And well, Steamboat in a sense used the chair at first, but because remember, I think as Luger held it, Steamboat catapulted him to the turnbuckle where Luger hit himself, but
yeah.
He wasn't disqualified because Steamboat did not touch the chair. If he doesn't touch the chair, then technically he doesn't use it. But after that, he picks it up and the referee tries to stop him.
And it rams
him. He shoves the referee to the ground and then used it.
Mm-hmm. So. Yep. But again, before they were wrestling very well. They were doing flips. They were doing suplexes. They were doing arm drags. They were doing takedowns. I think Dragon pulled up a couple moves from the top rope. Luger used all of his power. This was a match. And I hate to give credit to Lex, but this was one of his better matches in the early days of WCW. It really was.
I mean, that's just, See, I'm trying not to focus too much on the negatives, especially with the total package, Mr. Lex Luger. You see this match, like the high-flying martial arts dude versus, you know, the power-hitting muscle freak. Again, yeah. more of the 80s action stuff.
Absolutely. In WCW, not WWE. But it was more of a wrestling show. That's what this was. And it was just a whole lot of fun to watch. Yeah. It really was.
It was. And this has to be considered... One of the main event matches, yeah, and as you said, before the match, Luger protested that he wanted the match to have countouts and disqualifications, and Steamboat agreed because typical heel stuff, if it's not my way, we don't do it. Again,
that's
typical
right.
Heel stuff, which you know is very unique. So
it was
Steamboat took serious control, and then Luger actually attacked him outside the ring and then to try to fight back and It was a back and forth, you know, thriller.
It really
and the
was.
Way it end, and the way it ended.
I would have liked to have seen a clean win and Steamboat take the belt off him, but we didn't get that. That's okay.
And of course, you know, and obviously Luger, I mean, and because of Steamboat's status, I mean, Luger knew that if I pin him or whatever, that's going to affect him. And because Luger and Steamboat were making good money working together, Yeah, Luger's like, look, I got to watch out for Ricky as well.
They really do.
Yeah,
so.
That's just how. I mean, even today, back then, a wrestler knew, like, if you had like Abdullah the Butcher and the late Bruiser Brody, there was a reason why a majority of their matches always ended either with a disqualification or a no contest, with technically Bruiser Brody standing tall from the beatdowns, because Bruiser knew if he pins Abdullah the Butcher, it would cause a negative effect, because again, those two were making a lot of money working the matches, and one of the best rivalries in the history of pro wrestling. And for Abdullah, he knew that if Bruiser Brody, if I beat him, it's gonna make him make him look weak. So both guys had to make sure that they were both still in a high status to make sure the rivalry kept going, to make sure that they were able to draw money with the matches. Yep. So wrestlers had to make sure that each other's golden goose was in a good position. Understandably selfishly, but at the same time, it's for business. It's not just to put money in their pockets and for their families, but it's for the company as well and for the future of the business. You know,
want to keep
it's all part of the wrestling family. The kayfabe, like behind the curtains, mm-hmm. that people don't know about. Like, you're hated rivals on camera, but backstage, your business partners, you're even friends, but back then, to preserve kayfabe, you could not be seen in public eating or drinking together.
That's true.
You couldn't even be on the same plane.
No, you really couldn't.
Again, to preserve kayfabe. But again, a little besides the point, as our friend Ricky would say, I swear to God, mm-hmm. that's a quote that he uses that I always steal. But,
yes, he does.
But yeah, this United States title match, I like the match itself. The finish, okay, but I understand why they didn't take the belt off of Luger. And in your case, I understand why you wanted that to happen.
I was not a Lex Luger fan at any point in my life, by the way. Never have been.
I will say, seeing what physical state the guy's in now compared to what he was back then, I mean, I know that you have no remorse about it, but...
None.
But at the same time, I mean, those allegations, I mean, again, I want just more positive stuff.
You seem to have lost Alex for a second.
Total package.
Oh, he's back. Okay.
No, I'm here. Wait, what happened?
We lost you for a second. I'm going to say... There you go. I'm going to say this. I have zero to no respect for Lex Luger, and that's how I'm going to leave this one.
And that's the bottom line?
That's right. on to one half of what I call the double main event.
The fact that the Midnight Express were baby faces here, I mean, again, that's just, you know, something else that's much to everybody's surprise. I mean, the fact, two great tag teams from back then, the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors, and the Midnight Express with Paul Ellering and Jim Cornette.
It's just weird to see Paul Ellering and Jim Cornette on the same side.
I know, right?
On the other side,
you have the Freebirds and the Samoan SWAT team, one of them being Fatu, who, of course, we know is Rikishi. Yes. I believe his partner at the time was Samu.
Yes.
It was not Sione was when they were the head shrinkers. This was Samu.
This was Samu.
Pre-match promo from both sides, too. When first we saw the Freebirds cut their promo. And then, of course, you have the Samoan SWAT team like doing those savage, you know, wild beast kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Not speaking English, you know, like that. I mean, again, to preserve, you know, kayfabe, to keep the characters seeming looking real.
It really was. The interviews were fantastic. But did you notice something different about that War Games and today's War Games? There was actually a roof in this one. The cage was closer to the ring, and there was a roof. And today's War Games. There ain't no roof.
So I love how you said that. There ain't no roof, Mark. It's just the way you say it, Mark.
There was no roof today's. But today is a roof. So
you're so entertaining, brother.
Thank you. For them to use the cage like they did was great. To watch Hawk and Animal in this match, to watch Dr. Steve Williams even had his time in this match, and it was a much better run than he ever had in WWF, by the way, at any point in time.
The Brawl for
Freebirds,
All.
The Freebirds brutal, Hawk jumping from one ring over the ropes to the other ring was phenomenal without even a thought about it. What? There was action all over the place. Too. I was screaming that he loved it. This was War Games when it was War Games. This was what this was. This was brutal. There was no blood in it, but this was a brutal, brutal match. And that's what you want out of War Games. And I loved it. I really did.
There's really nothing to hate about this match, to be honest with you.
No. Hawk and Animal trying to go for the Doomsday Device, and it was stopped. Hawk pulling off the two or three neck breakers to get the win on poor John Garvin. This was just an amazing match. And by the way, this was the second time for LOD to be in the War Games, because 2 years prior they were in the first one against the Four Horsemen, and that one they won also, by the way. So this was just a phenomenal, phenomenal, brutal match. And it was a lot of fun to watch. It really was.
It was. And seeing Jimmy Garvin submit the way he did, I mean, how the referee comes in, referees like that, and how the referee just calls for the bell. I mean, especially when you see the villain submit and then the referee calling for the bell, that's extraordinarily unique. Now, I got to talk about the second pre-match interview, and this time with the babyfaces, with the Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that you have Steve Williams, you know, all of a sudden come like one side and then come to the other, how he said, "I'm bird hunting, baby."
Yeah, well, he was.
Of course, you know, the Fabulous Freebirds were the heels, and the brawling babyface saying, "I'm going bird hunting, baby."
It was just a great, great match. It was a great interview. I loved every second of it. And this is how the old War Games worked. There was no pinfalls this time. There was no referee in the ring. The referee stood outside the ring until somebody said, "Yeah, I submit because I can't take anymore. I'm sorry." That's what it was in the old WCW before we had what we have now. There was a roof. There was, "We're going to ram your head into the cage. There's going to be a 2-on-1. That guy in 2-on-1 is going to take a beating, whether you like it or not." Usually the heel team won the coin toss, and then when all 10 or all 8 men got in the ring, that's when the war started. And it usually did last a while. And this one lasted a while.
Honestly, I think the length of it was right.
It was. It really was.
And I like how you mentioned this match. There were no pinfalls. There was only two ways to win: either you tap out or you literally have to surrender.
That's it. Yeah. That's how they won it back then.
Except I think as far as the surrender goes, is it just one member or is it the whole entire team that has to surrender simultaneously?
One member has to surrender. That's all it takes.
So it's almost like an I Quit match. Like it's basically like a submission. It's like basically a combination of a submission match and an I Quit match as far as how the match has to end.
Except that it cannot end until all the members of both teams enter the ring.
Which is actually very, very interesting. Because, again, it's called War Games. You got to have a war, not a battle, a full-scale war.
You could literally beat a guy to death, and he cannot submit until all 10 men are in. You could literally rip a guy's body parts off until all 10 guys are in the ring. Now, TNA tried to copy this on the pay-per-view called Lockdown. It was successful one way, but I prefer the original War Games as it was in WCW. ROH had it one time. I have the DVD, the only time they ever tried it. ECW never tried it. Ring of Honor tried it a couple. Ring of Honor had their version of it only one time. So the original War Games has belonged to WCW, and I always thought the older versions were much better. They really were. But this was one of the better ones. This is up there with 1992 as some of the best. 87 was a good one. So watch it, guys. Go back on the network and watch them. You're going to love them all. Except for the later ones. Don't watch those. Those were terrible. Let's not go there.
And as the match ended, I think, you know, if I remember correctly, Road Warrior Animal was trapped because after the baby faces left, the heels stayed in, attacked him, and then, like two of them kind of like keep the door like that, and then they continue to attack Animal, and when the babyfaces finally get in, the heels retreat.
Sure, but that's how it was back then also.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it was. It's a fun match. It really is.
It was, yeah. I think, going back to the second interview, I think the Midnight Express started the pregame interview.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they sure did.
Like I mentioned, like, never did we ever think we would team up with the Road Warriors?
No.
Did they ever have a feud with the Road Warriors and the Midnight Express?
I don't recall, but I believe they did.
I mean, if they did, then obviously they would say, "Here we are teaming with somebody that we've had our issues with, but the past is the past. This is the then and now.
They had a scaffold. The Road Warriors had a scaffolding match against another team, and that's how Jim Cornette busted up his knees. from that scaffolding match. I don't know if it was him in that. I don't remember which. If I don't know which team it was, but I know Jim Cornette was the manager, and that's how he got his knees busted up. So they probably did in the past, but still, though, this was a lot of fun. This really was. On to the main event
for the NWA World Championship: Nature Boy Ric Flair versus Terry Funk.
There's the man, 16 times, baby. 16 times.
16 times.
And Cena, this is what a champion looks like. Sorry, how to get that in.
Yeah, well, you know.
Anyway, Terry Funk is his opponent with Gary Hart. We mentioned him again. And, of course, Flair's got to be Flair and bring out four gorgeous ladies with him. One of those $100,000 robes.
Listen, the first thing to remember is that Ric Flair was the face in this match, not the heel.
Yes, he was.
Because in the previous pay-per-view, Ric Flair became the new champion. And the previous pay-per-view was Wrestle War, if I'm correct.
Yes, an amazing show, by the way.
Yeah, so he beat Ricky Steamboat.
Yes.
And Terry Funk demanded a match for the title, which Flair refused, resulting in Funk attacking him. And I think he put him through a table and I think gave him a pile driver on the concrete and injured his neck.
Well, that's what we're about to mention, that Ric Flair wrestled this. Ric Flair did wrestle did this match with a bad neck. This match started off on the floor, loose rules, the referee just let him go. There was an iron used in this match. They both bled heavily. This was not your typical Ric Flair match. It really wasn't. It was a typical Terry Funk match, but it wasn't your typical Ric Flair match. So Ric Flair, out of character, used a pile driver not once but twice in this match. I've never seen Flair use the pile driver except in this match. I've never seen him do that. He didn't do go over the top rope and do the whole, you know, trying to fly over the top rope thing. This was just a brawl. That's what this was. It started off as a brawl and it ended as a brawl. They used the iron, both men got hit with the iron, both men bled. Ah, what a match. What a match. What a great match this was.
And not surprisingly, Ric Flair bled during the match. I mean, he pretty much always bled in every single one of his matches.
Yep.
You know, I'm just surprised that Flair didn't win by submission. He actually pinned him. Pinned him in a cradle, I believe.
Well, Flair was going for the figure four and Terry Funk cradled him, and then Flair reversed for the three count. And that's how the match ended. And then, of course, the big scrum pileup happened at the end. But this match was brutal. This match was a lot of blood, a lot of brutality. But again, you have to love that kind of match. You really do. On a stack card like this, it was just a lot of fun to watch.
It was, and the match itself, you know, it was a back and forth thing.
It was,
but that's what we wanted to see. Now, this is actually what I mean. The feud between Terry Funk and Ric Flair continued on because it led to eventually one of the best matches in wrestling today: Flair versus Terry Funk in the I Quit match.
Yes, a match that I've seen several times. Very brutal, very bloody, but this match was the start of an amazing. This was match started an amazing feud. It really was. It went for a while. Flair and Funk just proven what happens when you're a talented wrestler and you're talented at what you do. Jim Ross called the match perfectly. By the way, he really did. So the commentator, both men using the pile driver, both men taking it to the floor, both men using the guardrail. As we said, they used the iron. The win with the cradle and then the big scrum at the end. It was just a fantastic match. It really was, Alex. I loved it. I really did.
And you know, of course, you know, in the aftermath, in the next show, actually, Ric Flair defended the title against Terry Funk and the Great Muta.
Yeah,
I think it was a Hell in a Cell match, and Bruno Sammartino was the special guest referee.
It was actually It was actually a tag team cage match with Sammartino as the referee. Yeah,
well, that's right. It was Ric Flair and Sting. Okay, I forgot, because I was like, at first I was looking at the card like, well, where the heck is Sting? Because Sting in the aftermath actually lost. As you said, there was a tournament, and Great Muta actually became the champion. So Sting did end up losing the television title to Muta.
Yes.
So yeah, in that one, the main event, it was Ric Flair and Sting against Funk and the Great Muta. A Thunderdome match, and Bruno Sammartino was the special guest referee, and this was Halloween Havoc in Philadelphia.
I remember because I saw Halloween Havoc 89, by the way, another amazing show, by the way. But I'll put it to this.
I'm going to have to watch.
I suggest everybody watch it. You're going to love it. I watched it myself. Mm-hmm. This was such a dynamic match because it proved what you can do when you actually have talent. It can prove what you can do when you wrestle. The whole card was there. All nine matches were entertaining. What a great show. I loved it. This is a show, if you have the network, you can go back and watch over and over again, and you're not going to be bored. This is what WCW brought in the 80s before the unfortunate Eric Bischoff era.
Hostile takeover, right?
Yes, before the whole Hogan Eric Bischoff era. Don't watch anything after that era, by the way. Please save yourselves. But
except for the Sting matches, right?
Of course. The 80s and the early 90s, WCW used to bring a lot of fun stuff. They really did. They were a wrestling show. They were not showmen. They were wrestling. That's the difference between the two companies.
Well, I will say the 1994 Bash of the Beach, Hogan versus Flair. I will say, I did like the match. I mean, I'm not. Before Mark pukes, let's talk about what happened after Flair beat Funk. Basically, when Muta came to the ring, gave the green mist to Flair and then started beating him down. And then Funk tries to pile drive Flair into a chair to injure him. Of course, this is all part of the story. But still, I mean, such a stunt is dangerous. But
it is.
But eventually Sting makes his way down the ring. But this continued to spell out. It spelled out to the audience and to near the backstage. I mean,
sure, they even fought by the where the announcers were standing.
Yeah, Jim Ross invites Flair, and then Flair brings Flair. In Sting. Like, kind of like a father bringing his teenage son to an interview. I mean, see the fact that Flair and Sting once enemies but now on the same page.
It was just a fun show. It really was.
Yeah, I have to make up for the fact that I just 30 seconds ago I made Mark sick to his stomach by the 1994 Bash of the Beach, Hogan versus Flair. I mean,
God, please. Yeah,
okay, I mean, come on. Even the other day, it wasn't the worst match you had ever seen. But I get it. You don't like Hulk Hogan, and of course that's whatever. But again. The brawling between Muta and then Sting and Flair and Funk. I mean, of course, at the end, you see the baby faces stand tall while the heels retreat.
And Ric Flair with the big woo on the camera with the two announcers there, and Sting comes in. That was the next challenge. That led to the next video at Halloween Havoc. And Alex, anytime you want to watch that, let me, watch it. And then if you want to cover it, we will gladly cover it. I absolutely loved this show. I really do. And, I hate to cut this a little short, but I have to. But I got to get going because I have something waiting for me. So,
we've actually reached the end of the line anyway. Mm-hmm. So, ladies and gentlemen, this was basically a bit of a discussion of the 1989 Great American Bash.
What a show!
And I am absolutely tempted to watch the 1989 Halloween Havoc as well as the Starcade, which was what actually supposed to watch. But somehow I thought that Mark told me the Great American Bash. But Mark said either way, those are both good shows. So we're actually going to continue this, and I'd like to watch them from the other years, from the 88, 86, the days of wrestling, ladies and gentlemen. And you can find Ringside Chaos wherever you get your podcast. So please hit that subscribe button, hit that notification bell so you do not miss out on any exciting upcoming content. One more thing, a shout out to Chris. That was actually part of yesterday's Pipe Bomb Radio New York City show. Chris will, in fact, be on this show in the future. He's the recent subscriber. He loves the show. So shout out to you, Chris. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Braverman, thank you so much. Y'all have a good one, and God bless.
Have a good night, everybody. And please don't forget about 9/11 ever. Never forget this day. Never.
Never. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Moreno is a MAGA mistake for black families. If Moreno is elected senator, he'll push to eliminate diversity, equality, and inclusion programs as part of the racist MAGA Republican Project 2025. We've come too far to let extremists like Bernie Moreno take us back. MAGA Moreno is a mega mistake for Ohio. Register to vote by October 7th at OhioVoterGuide.org and re-elect Senator Sherrod Brown. Paid for by Win Senate, which is responsible for the content of this ad. WinSenate.org, not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.